My friends, in terms of elemental racial justice in this country, we stand right now at one of the most dangerous and reactionary moments in our nation's history. Segregation of black and Latino kids has returned to public education with a vengeance from one coast to the other. Proportion of black kids now attending segregated schools, that is, deeply segregated schools, is at its highest level since the death of Martin Luther King in 1968. We've gone right back to where we were before. The rivers of blood and nights of struggle have brought us to this point, and so many seem willing to surrender.
That's Jonathan Kozel, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm Sam Fuqua. This edition of AR features Jonathan Kozel on Education, the Shame of the Nation. Almost 4 years ago, and with much fanfare, President Bush signed the No Child Left Behind law. It placed sweeping new requirements on schools, teachers, and students for greater accountability and improved performance on standardized tests. But the new mandates did not come with enough new money, and the narrow focus on testing for a few basic skills is squeezing out other school subjects deemed non-essential and too expensive. Against that backdrop, inner-city schools continue to struggle with crowded classrooms full of lower-income students of color. The white students are often in schools with more money and better facilities. For many districts, it's a segregated and unequal system. Jonathan Kozel has documented these inequities for decades as a public school teacher and as an author. He won the National Book Award for Death at an Early Age, his book about teaching in the Boston public schools. His other books include Amazing Grace and Illiterate America. His latest book is The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid in American Schooling. Jonathan Kozel spoke in Portland, Oregon.
I feel very, very close to teachers, especially the ones who work with little kids in elementary school. I have to admit, that's what I used to teach, and I have a special soft spot for teachers who work in those grades. I just think they do the best thing it is to do on earth, bring joy and beauty, mystery and mischief to the hearts of little pint-sized people. And sometimes when I'm visiting a school, I get trapped in the principal's office, and a teacher sees me and just grabs me. She rescues me. It's usually a female, you know, little kids. She grabs me by the arm and drags me off to her classroom. I love that. Then when we get there, she puts me on the spot and says, okay, teach something, you know, do something. And I always ask the wrong kind of question because I sort of forgot how to do it. And I get all the kids jumping out of their seats, you know. They're all waving their hands. And as every elementary school teacher knows, little kids, especially around the age of 6 or 7, usually have only a theoretical connection to their chair. You know, they have this power to defy gravity. And they're all waving their hands at me, and typically, like, there's one right in the front row, like a little girl who's just waving her hand right in my face, like, as though she's going to poke my eyes out. And she's saying, ooh, 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 as though she's going to die if I don't call on her. And so I call on her, and she looks up at me with sweet bewilderment, and she says, what? She just wanted me to call on her. That was it. It's a humbling experience to go back and try to do the real thing. I sometimes think that every arrogant politician in our nation's capital, Mr. Bush especially, who talks so condescendingly about the failings of the classroom teachers in this nation, ought to be obliged to come into an inner city classroom once a year and teach a class and find out what it's like, because it's all too easy to forget. Mr. Bush accuses teachers in our urban schools of harboring, quote, low expectations for our students. And he says, instead, we should strive for excellence. You know, as though we all really came into this career because we were genetically predisposed to mediocrity. And, you know, excellence. Wow. Thank you, Mr. President. What an idea. And, you know, and if we can't pump the scores enough to please his accountability technicians, then he says we are guilty of soft bigotry. Have you heard him say that? Soft bigotry. He says that a lot. Soft bigotry of low expectations. As you know, it's like once he finds a phrase he can pronounce, he keeps repeating it. And the president says that testing is the answer to our problems. And in many urban schools, as a result, high-stakes testing starts in first grade, if not earlier. NCLB requires third grade. And in New York, for example, New York City third grade, is if you don't pass your high-stakes test, you can't be promoted. It's very important. Many districts start even earlier now, as early as first grade, in order to use it as a way to filter off the gifted and talented, right? Which is the first step in a long stage of internal tracking that ends up with predominantly white AP classes. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. And, I mean, in some districts in California, they've started high-stakes tests in kindergarten, and one principal said, if this is what Washington's demanding, we got to get them ready. And these are bubble tests. These are not like nice diagnostic tests. How many of you have ever heard of the E-class? Oh, there's like three real elementary school teachers here. How about the rest of you? E-class is a diagnostic test. I didn't mean to tease anybody. Man, I was just showing off because I've heard of it. And I'd actually helped do it once. And, you know, they're not giving the kids tests like that where the teacher keeps a running record and draws conclusions which are useful. No, no, no. These are bubble tests. They're giving in several districts, overwhelmingly minority districts naturally in California, in the first month of school, September of kindergarten. And the little kids who are very poor in these districts, they don't yet know how to hold a pencil. And many of them don't even know that print goes from left to right. And the teacher can't help them. And they have to fill in these little bubbles like on the SAT answer form. Isn't that amazing? And the little children pee in their pants. And the principal of one of these schools is so anxious that his scores won't look good. Kindergarten. He's so worried that the kindergarten scores won't look good that he's like canceled recess and nap time. Nap time to have extra 20 minutes to get drill these kids for their tests. Who's thinking up things like this? I sometimes think there's like a little room in Washington, maybe like in the basement of the Heritage Foundation, where basically miserable people, sociopaths, spend their days, you know, devising ways to make life miserable for little children. If at least you gave these little kids terrific pre-K education, they'd have some chance of surviving these exams. But this is not the case in most of the United States. I started this book tour in Washington. We launched the book, the Children's Defense Fund, my beloved friend Marion Wright Edelman introduced the book to the public. And Marion told me that the percentage of poor children in America who get Head Start now is at its lowest level in many, many years, since during the Bush administration, the percentage of eligible children has dropped below 50%. But that's not the worst of it. In most of the really poor neighborhoods I visit, it's a much lower number. It's a far lower number. And you know how you find out? You don't need to go to some data bank. All you have to do is, like, go into kindergarten and sit, squeeze yourself into one of those little teeny-weeny chairs, and ask the kids, what did you do last year? That's the best way to find out. And if they get too confused or bashful to tell you, ask the teacher, because the kindergarten teacher knows. And typically the answer that I get in inner-city schools from the South Bronx to Chicago to L.A. is maybe a third of them got something for half a day for 1 year. More often, it's a quarter. Sometimes they'll say just a handful. Meanwhile, my affluent white friends, like my Harvard classmates, who, you know, they still talk to me. Sometimes I have to go and have dinner with them sometimes. And that, you know, they're a little nervous with me. Because they think I want to redistribute their wealth. Which I do, but they tell me that they tell me what they do for their own kids or grandchildren, and I know. You can't fool me because I've seen both sides. You understand? I grew up in privilege. And I spend most of my life, I'm certainly more at home, on the other side of the wall, among the little kids that I've been working with all these years in very poor neighborhoods. But I know the other side. And I often feel, remember that beautiful song of, was it Judy Collins? I've looked at life from both sides now. Joni Mitchell wrote it, that's right. I've seen it. You know, I see it from both sides. And you can't fool me about injustice. I'll tell you what the privileged do for their own preschoolers in cities like New York and Los Angeles. They send their kids to these spectacular, beautiful, rich developmental pre-K programs, typically starting at the age of 2 or 2.5. And these are lovely programs. These aren't drill and grill academies like Mr. Bush wants to do to Head Start. These are typically Montessori schools, places like that. Gentle, warm, maternal grown-ups. The kids aren't, you know, they don't have the kids at the age of 2.5 chanting vowel sounds and consonant blends. But, you know, they learn a lot of stuff gently, like maybe they have a reading rug. Do you know what a reading rug is? And maybe like the teacher might say, all right, Susie, I think today we'll have you sit on a short A, you know, or long O. I think you could use a little help with long O. Or we'll have Peter sit on a consonant blend. And just sort of learn it by osmosis. It comes up through his rear end. You know? But these are nice places. And the best of these pre-Ks in New York cost $22,000 a year. $22,000. The top ones are called the Baby Ivies. Baby Ivies. So there's no pretense of a meritocracy here, right? Rigging the game before it starts. The competition to get into the top pre-Ks in New York, in Manhattan, is so intense that they have interviews. They interview two-year-olds. Now, what do you ask a two-year-old? I don't know. To me, they're like gerbils, these interviews are so important that there's a new profession in New York called pre-K interview coaching. So for like $500 an hour, you can hire someone to coach your two-year-old on
how to really hit that interview. Meanwhile, the little ones I know are typically sitting at home in front of a TV or staring out the window. A couple of years later, they're all in public school. Give them high-stakes tests. Who does best on those tests? The ones who have been at home staring out the window or looking at TV, or the ones who have been in these beautiful pre-K programs? I'd like to say, to me, it's especially outrageous to impose so many high-stakes tests on children in the early grades of school if we have first denied them any opportunity for pre-K education. There's something deeply hypocritical. And I wish I'd hear this from more school administrators. You know, they don't talk about this enough. There's something, and if I say anything bad about a school administrator, it applies to everyone in the country except Portland, naturally. I want to be invited back, but I don't want to get all my friends in trouble for associating with me, but or maybe I do. We shall see before the evening's out. But to me, you know, there's something deeply hypocritical in a society that holds a little kid, 7 or 8 years old, in third grade, second, third grade, a little 7 or 8 year old girl, we hold her accountable. That's the big word now. Accountable for her performance on a standardized exam, but doesn't hold the president and Congress accountable for robbing her of what they gave their own kids 6 years earlier. It's outrageous. My friends, in terms of elemental racial justice in this country, we stand right now at one of the most dangerous and reactionary moments in our nation's history. Segregation of black and Latino kids has returned to public education with a vengeance from one coast to the other. I've just spent 5 years visiting 60 public schools, 11 states. If you took a photo of the classes that I'm visiting in the inner city schools, in most, you know, vast majority of the inner city schools I visit, if you took a photo, a color photograph of the classes that I'm visiting, you could not distinguish those photos from pictures in old textbooks of classrooms in Alabama in 1935 or 1940. I simply never see white children. Proportion of black kids now attending segregated schools, that is, deeply segregated schools, is at its highest level since the death of Martin Luther King in 1968. We've gone right back to where we were before. Rivers of blood and nights of struggle had brought us to this point, and so many seem willing to surrender. The most segregated states for children, minority kids in America, are New York, Michigan, Illinois, and California. In New York, which is now the epicenter of segregation in American public schooling, 7 out of every 8 black kids goes to a segregated school. I walk into these classrooms and look around me at the faces of the children, some of whom in New York City I've known since they were born, because I've been writing books about the South Bronx for about 15 years. And I look at the kids, and if I have the nerve, I look into their eyes. And I usually see them looking into my eyes, too, because little children search the eyes of grown-ups all the time. And I look around the room. I look at the peeling paint. I look at the overwhelmed atmosphere of a teacher trying so hard against these odds. And you know, I always think, well, maybe there's one white child somewhere. He's in the bathroom, and he'll come back in a minute. You know. There's no white kids in these schools, and I try so hard to tell myself that this postmodern and millennial apartheid is what Dr. King and all our other martyrs died for. Although about half my book takes place in the Northwest, in Seattle, and in California, and all over the country. But the little neighborhood that I've written about most in the South Bronx about 2 years ago, there were 11,000 children in the elementary schools. 11,000, okay? Of those 11,000, exactly 26 were white. Now, I'm not too good at arithmetic. I went to a progressive school, but I did learn long division, and that's a segregation rate of 99.8%. 0.2 percentage point now mark the difference between legally enforced apartheid in the South of 50 years ago and socially and economically enforced apartheid in the vast majority of northern cities now. The ultimate irony, and this is something black folks, older black teachers always point out to me with a kind of bitter humor. If you come to a new city, if I come to a new city, and you want to see, and they say to me, if you want to see a really segregated school, just ask for a school that's named for Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks or, you know, and Thurgood Marshall. And in New York, there's a school, they wanted to honor Jackie Robinson. Remember Jackie Robinson? Y'all know what he's famous for, along with being a good ball player? They broke the color line in baseball. He started integration in Major League Baseball. School, they named a school for Jackie Robinson. A perennially failing school is 97% black and Latino. There's a school in New York named for Fannie Lou Hamer, one of the great warriors of the civil rights struggle in the South, the freedom movement in the South in Mississippi. That's 98% black and Hispanic. There's a school named for one of my favorite poets, Langston Hughes, 99% black and Latino. A few of these schools in some cities that have these names are good schools. If there's one in Portland, I'll assume it's one of the good ones, just to be polite. But most of them aren't, to be blunt with you. Most of these schools that are named for people like Dr. King, Thurgood Marshall, etc., are in ugly, old, antiquated buildings, have the lowest funding, largest class size, largest turnover of teachers, worst outcomes, and the lowest graduation rates. And they're always depressing places, frankly. I visit a lot of them. And you know, I always wonder, like, why do we name those kinds of schools for people that black folks love? Why not name those schools for people black folks don't like? You know, like William Bennett School of Personal Morality. Or Clarence Thomas Academy of Self-Help and Self-Hate. George Bush Academy of Garbled Syntax and Inept Vocabulary. Save the name of Dr. King for a school that lives up to his dream. Virtually all these schools that I describe are shamefully unequal to the schools that serve the mainstream in America. I'm not going to rehash documentation I've given in other books, but I'll just give you an update. The little ones I write about in the South Bronx, they get about $11,000 a year put into their public education. That may sound high to you, but $11,000 in New York because of the extraordinary cost of living is like about $7,000 anywhere else in America. About $11,000 per pupil. Now, some of you have read about the little kids I've described. I think, have any of you read Amazing Grace or Ordinary Resurrections? On the cover of Ordinary Resurrections, you'll see a picture of one of my favorite kids, Pineapple. Pineapple's this adorable, plump little girl. I met her in kindergarten, and right from kindergarten, she had this ability to boss me and make me obey her. And, you know, there's certain little kids who are like that, who are so brilliantly manipulative that instead of
instead of getting mad, you sort of become fascinated trying to figure out how they make you do whatever they want and why you obey them. And she's very good at that. She's like just plump and bossy, like a little Oprah Winfrey kind of. And she's smart, too. And you know, and everyone obeys her. Hillary Clinton came up there once to visit with me. And when Hillary goes anywhere, you know, she's followed by reporters. And it happens that Robert Novak was right next to her when they were doing a photo, because they take pictures of her everywhere. And he was right there, and he always gives me bad dreams. I don't know why. He just looks like some mean, mean person. And he's right next to her, and Pineapple, actually, a little bossy girl, says, "You, get out of the picture." But he's spoiling the picture. It's funny. So anyway, there's little Pineapple in all her glory. And she's worth $11,000 to America. That's what we spend on it. You lift her up in your good and kind and grown-up arms, and you plump Pineapple down just 15 minutes away in the first suburb north of the Bronx, which is called Bronxville. Bronxville, some of you might know, is the site of a famous college. It's a college called Sarah Lawrence. Have you heard of that? You lift up Pineapple from her $11,000 school in the South Bronx. You plunk her down 15 minutes away in Bronxville, overwhelmingly white. She'd be getting $19,000 put into her public education every year. Lift her up again and plunk her down in a super rich white suburb on Long Island of New York, like Manhasset, which, if you don't know that part of the country, is comparable to Mercer Island near Seattle or Beverly Hills, and she'd be getting $22,000 a year put into her public education. These aren't private schools, it's public education. We say in church or synagogue, I happen to be Jewish, that all our children are of equal value in the eyes of God. And in the eyes of God, my friends, I'm sure they are. But not in the eyes of America. In the eyes of America, because the unjust, undemocratic, and archaic way we finance public education, these little kids I know come into the classroom with a price tag printed on their forehead. They are cheap children. It seems awful to say it, because I love them. But these are Kmart babies. You want to see a Lord and Taylor baby? A Neiman Marcus baby? You got to go out to the white suburbs. Now, I have rich friends who live in the $22,000 suburbs, and they always ask me, and these are the same people who make me come for dinner, you know. I always get trapped in those situations. I've always had this bad luck of having people I don't really like me. And so I'm there at dinner, and they'll say to me, and typically the man will say this to me, he'll say, "Jonathan..." Actually, now I don't want to misquote something. Actually, a Republican member of the Senate once said this to me after a hearing, but I've heard the same thing from a lot of my Harvard classmates who are about the same age. This is because I know some Republicans, you know, and like some. Well, a few, you know. And this was a seemingly compassionate Republican member of the Senate. After I testified once, he said, "You know, your books make me cry." I was really moved because to make a Republican cry. And then he corrected himself. He said, "Well, actually, they make my wife cry." But he said, "Just tell me one thing, Jonathan." Like grabs me by the elbow. And he holds my elbow. Like we were old friends, kind of. And maybe he feels that way because I look like the same social class. Do you understand? Probably about our neckties at the same place or something. And he says, you know, he's squeezing my elbow and he says, "Just tell me one thing, like man to man now. Can you really solve this kind of problem by throwing money at it?" You know, after I've described all this, and when they say that, when people ask me that, no U.S. senator ever speaks of throwing money at the Pentagon. No, they allocate money for the Pentagon. They throw money at anything that has to do with human decency or pain.
So when he says this to me, can you really solve this kind of problem by throwing money at it? I say, sure, that's the best way to do it. Throw it. Dump it from a helicopter. Give it to me. I don't know a better way to put a new roof on a collapsing school. I don't know a better way to stock one of these sparse and barren libraries with a wonderful, rich, super beautiful collection of all those lovely books by Eric Carle, you know, like the very, 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 very hungry caterpillar. I love that book. It's one of my, I read that at bedtime. I love it. And I don't know a better way than money to stock a inner city classroom with good computers and software. You know, strange as it seems, they actually make you pay money for those things. And I don't know a better way than money to take one of these wonderful, these beautiful young idealistic teachers whom I recruit everywhere I can, everywhere I go, the best universities. You know, I sometimes feel that's my role in life, is to take people who are planning to go to business school and, you know, and ruin their lives by convincing them to become third grade teachers. And you know, I don't know a better way than money to take these wonderful young idealists bursting with the longing to do good and to serve the children, the poor. I don't know a better way than money to take them and pay them enough so they won't just stay there for 2 years while they're still high on one of my books, but will stay there for a lifetime, because that's what we need to do with young idealists. But still, my friends, all these wealthy friends of mine, and these, I'm talking not about, you know, Neolithic right-wing nuts. I'm talking about people who think they're liberals, my Harvard classmates, typically. And they'll say to me over dinner, or like over dessert, typically, they'll save this for the end of the evening, you know, they'll say, well, Jonathan, still, you know, admittedly it's unfair. I have a lot of them say, well, life just isn't fair, is it, Jonathan? And I say, well, that's true, but, you know, don't compound the unfairness so arduously, you know. And the typical final question is, can you really buy your way to better education for poor children? And now, these are the people whose kids go to the $22,000 public schools. A lot of them don't even send their kids to those terrific high schools. They send them to beautiful, very, more expensive private schools. That's when they really pour on the money, these wealthy people. Friends of mine, starting in secondary school, will send their kids to top New England prep schools if they can get them in. Like Andover, have you ever heard of that? Exeter, Groton, these are top schools. I know them very well. As I said, you can't fool me. I grew up in privilege. I live 10 minutes from Andover. You know, and these are the schools that educate presidents of the United States and the sons of presidents who become presidents and so forth. And Mr. Bush went to Andover, actually. He went to Andover. While he was there, I'm told the English department was on leave. But listen, no kidding. Andover is a terrific school. Have you ever heard the conservatives ask you whether class size really matters? You really going to improve a school by having smaller class size? Listen, in Andover, you know what the class size is typically? I know, because they invite me to come and talk about injustice there. It's that curse, you know, my life, like the irony. And, they assign my books there. And so, and it's 12. 12 is a typical class there. 12 or 14, maybe, sitting around a lovely maple seminar table with soft deflecting table lamps. And nice tweedy teacher. You know what Andover costs right now? All those schools, New England, they're way over $30,000 a year now for each student. With all the extras, they're like $40,000 a year. So there is my friend there, you know, sitting with me at dinner. And he has two kids, typically two kids, at boarding school at once, spending like $80,000 a year to guarantee their children the royal road to Harvard, Yale, or Princeton, you know. And he has the nerve to look me in the eyes and ask me, you know, can you really buy your way to better education? Then typically, you know, they save it for coffee and dessert. It's like the question comes with the creme brulee. And, you know, and he looks me right in the eye and says, can you really? And these are like, he sounds sensible. He almost thinks I'll agree with his question. You know what I mean? Say, can you really buy your way to better education? And, you know, I'm a polite person, but sometimes it's late at night, and I've had a couple of glasses of wine. I'll just look him in the eyes and say, I don't know. It seems to do the trick for your kids, doesn't it? The results are seen in chaotic and squalid buildings. To me, that's very important. I think aesthetics counts a lot in education. They never ask, is this a miserable place to spend your childhood? They don't have any rubric charts for misery, right? They don't have any AYP for squalor. They don't have any benchmarks for how unhappy your childhood is going to be. They ought to. We measure every other damn thing about these children. We ought to measure whether they take any pleasure in their childhood. I think it's very important. I go to a high school in New York, a big, awful high school, and the principals, of course, never invite me to go to the cafeteria. You know why. That the kids bring me down. They'll say, come on, we'll take you to lunchroom hell. That's what they call it. And this big high school in the Bronx, 4,000 kids, they had to have like 7 lunch shifts, the first one at 9:20 in the morning. Out in L.A. at Fremont High, 5,000 kids. So many kids there that half of them didn't have classrooms. They're in trailers. Trailers. In Los Angeles, they call these trailers bungalows. They don't look like bungalows. You know, to me, bungalows are cute. Like with Jack and Jill, or Hansel and Gretel or something. These are smelly trailers. And I go into to a classroom there, and one of the wonderful teachers that I know brings me to her 10th grade social studies class. She has 40 kids in that class. Now, you know, it's one thing to read that in state reports. It's another thing to walk into the class and see it. And I'd just been at a wonderful suburban school back east with 16 kids in the class, okay? And then there's these prep schools with 12 in a class, okay? And here's 40 kids, not a white kid in the building. There's like 5,000 black and Latino children. And I said to her, how the hell do you teach 40 kids? And she had 6 classes like this every day. And I said, how the hell do you do it? And she says, here, find out. And she gave me her class. And I taught 40 kids. And they were nice kids, honestly. They knew I was a writer, and they poured their feelings out. And they were so eloquent, they asked if we could do a second hour. So it was the last hour of school, so we went for 2 hours. And I kind of loved those kids, and I never forgot that day. That was one of the most moving days of my life. Upset me terribly. It was a vile, horrible, filthy school. It still is. It's called Fremont High. And I know the superintendent of the Los Angeles schools. I've known all these guys for years. And, you know, and I like them usually personally, but boy, I don't see how he can live it. I don't see how he can sleep at night. I don't mean to make this ad hominem, but his name is Roy Romer. And I don't see how he can sleep at night. I don't think he ought to be able to sleep well at night. These kids were all very moving, and I'm not going to tell you every kid I meet is eloquent as Sandra Cisneros or William Butler Yeats, but some of them are. And there was one girl there, I'll never forget, named Mariah, who was about 16, who was clearly very smart and capable of going to a good college. And she wanted to take college and honors courses, but she told me she'd been tracked somehow the year before into taking a sewing class. She starts to cry, and she said, I had to take sewing last year. And now, she said, they're telling me I have to take hairdressing, right? And I remembered my first year as a teacher in 64. in Boston. I used to wonder why they were taking little black girls out of fourth grade to do sewing in the morning. But now I thought, surely they don't do that anymore. There it is, in Los Angeles today. That's why I'm so mad at the superintendent there. His name is Roy Romer. Did I say that before? I'm just furious with him. I must have seemed a little incredulous, because another student in the class, this is a black student, there's all either black or Latino kids. There's a lot of camaraderie between them, you know? And this black student, who I really got to like, she was like little. She was real little. She looked like a seventh grader, but she was very sassy. She's stylish and sort of, she had these blue rectangular tinted glasses tilted up on her forehead. They're very sporty looking. She wasn't that nice to me, but I liked her because she was so blunt. She says, listen, I took two hairdressing classes. I said, you get credit for that? She said, yes. I said, what are they? She said, hairdressing and advanced hairdressing. It's like AP hairdressing. I said, I don't believe you could get credit for that. She looks me right in the eyes, and she says, mister, we see in more than y'all can see. Isn't that an interesting statement? There's a little bit of Mississippi in her voice. You know, we see in more than y'all can see. And at that point, Mariah starts to cry in front of everyone. And she says, I don't want to take hairdressing. I didn't need sewing either. I knew how to sew because my mother is a seamstress in a garment factory. I'm trying to go to college. I don't think you need to sew to go to college. My mother sews. I hoped for something more. And I said, what did you want to take, Mariah? And she said, I wanted to take AP English. Oh, this is like cognitive decapitation. This isn't bureaucratic accident, you know. This is enacted racism. At that point, but I don't say this in the book. I don't need to because the kids are so eloquent. A boy in the class named Fortino, a Latino guy who sort of looked like a Latino Malcolm X because he was angry looking. But he had this kind of long hair and looked a little like Che Guevara in a way. I mean, he had long stringy hair and this look of cynical intelligence just loaded into his eyes, his dark eyes. He looks right at her and he says, listen to me, Mariah. The owners of the sewing factories need laborers, don't they? And she says, sort of shyly, I guess they do. And he says, they're not going to hire their own kids for those jobs, are they? And another student says, why not? And Mariah says, so they can grow beyond themselves in life, but we remain the same. I'm going to just make a final comment about testing and then...
Now maybe I'll make another final comment after this.
The worst to me is the distortion of curriculum that's resulting from high-stakes testing. And see, and about a quarter of my book is devoted to this subject. I go into great detail because I listen to teachers everywhere telling me, and I've participated in these classes. And listen, my heart goes out to the principals. I don't demonize the principals of these schools who feel they have to force this stuff on their teachers because they're in a constant state of anxiety, because their superintendents are in a constant state of anxiety, because the business corporate world is breathing down their neck, and behind the corporate world is, Mr. Bush and that man who's the vice president, I always forget his name, what is it, Cheney, you know. And, you know, all these awful people. And so they're all scared. And the some good principals are doing bad things out of anxiety. And it's not hurting the suburban schools as much. No one likes it. No one likes it. But the richest suburban schools I visit, the principals tend to say to their teachers, look, our kids are going to go to good colleges anyway. Take it easy. Okay? You can still be normal. You can still have a personality in school. It's in these test-driven, low-performing schools that are under state watch. And every city, they have a different, every state has a different name for this. In New York, they humiliate the principals of these schools because they name the worst schools in the tabloid newspapers. In my book, I quote that wonderful Nazi paper, the New York Post, that says, like, that they don't just name the lowest performing schools, they say the dirty dozen, you know, the worst 12 schools in our city. I know the principal of one of those schools, and I see her crying, you know. And what's happening in a lot of these schools is teachers are essentially being handed scripts to read, scripted instruction, maybe not here, but in a lot of places I go. And they're also being told they have to hold timers in their hands, not a little pocket watch like this, a real timer that rings after 2 minutes, because not 1 minute can be wasted on a skill that won't be tested on the exams. They have to write every damn thing they're going to do up on the blackboard or chalkboard or wall somewhere beforehand with a number of the state standard in front of it. Now, I bet they don't do that in this enlightened state, do they? Do they make anyone do that here? No. Well, watch out. And if they try to force this on you, just say no. To quote some famous person, I forget who that was. Just say no, because this is crazy. In almost all the states, this may still be a progressive exception, almost all the states, the teachers have to do this in the underperforming schools. You can't write on the board or tell the principal later, I read an early lyrical poem by W. H. Auden, Robert Frost, or Langston Hughes, to my third graders, and they loved it. Now, you can't say that. You have to say, I used, and you shouldn't say used, you have to say utilized. I utilized, because these standards people, you know, they want you to use big words. And they're like, I think most of the standards, including the one in Washington State, the WASL, and the one in Massachusetts is just horrible. I think they're written by like mediocre intellectuals who, like many such people, compensate for their basic insecurity by using polysyllabic words, wherever simple words would actually do quite well. And so, you know, you take a good old-fashioned word like skill, add three syllables, call it a proficiency, and they just meld into a pool of satisfaction. You're willing to be as pretentious as they are. It adds nothing. And, you know, and you can't say copy something. Replicate, you know. You can't, like, just do it. You have to initiate, you know. Implement. I don't know any, you know, if I ask a teacher, what are you doing this morning? She talks in real English. You know, she doesn't say, well, we're implementing Winnie the Pooh or something. My God. And she starts talking like that. And, you know, I'm going to switch to a different profession. But the awful, and the scripted curricula are typically called teacher-proof. That, what a way to welcome young teachers, right? This is so perfect that even you can't ruin it, basically. But the awful thing is they can't just let children enjoy literature. They've got to manipulate it to be used in some way. You know, I used William Butler Yeats to deliver English language skill 265B, whatever it might be, homonyms or something, you know. And you think, you know, poor William Butler Yeats. You know, would he have written that poem if he knew that would be done to it someday? And in New York, I walked into one class, believe it or not, it was just a class on writing stories. And on the wall, it says, and this was an intelligent young teacher I knew who ought to have known better, but he was terrified by, and the principal was terrified, so everyone was doing this crazy thing. On the wall, it said, ELA, now that means English Language Arts, number 67B. It's in my book. You can find it there, so it's true. You know, if it's in my book, it must be true. And it says, ELA 67B, children will demonstrate the production of a narrative procedure. Well, I thought, well, I went to a pretty good college. I majored in English. I don't know what the hell that means. What is the production of a narrative procedure? So I asked him. He says, it just means write a story. I said, why can't you say that?
He said, no, no, they want the standards written on the board the way they wrote it. And said, that doesn't teach children anything. It just teaches them pretentiousness. And pity the poor child who goes out in the street and repeats that. Said, what did you do in school today? Oh, I was producing a narrative procedure. And you know, so, and even the sweetest things have to be used in these ways. Even the soft perplexities of poo, or the sorrowful pronouncement of Eeyore. You know, I love Eeyore. I think he's one of the great tragic figures of Western literature, up there with Lear. You can't just enjoy them. They have to be treated as a kind of quarry from which state proficiencies can be hacked out and excavated and numbered and held up to the bright light of curricular illumination. You should just refuse to let anyone do that to you in the classroom. Just don't do it. So, no. The good teachers that I know everywhere in the country deeply dislike this anti-intellectual, proto-military, robotic tendency in schools that serve the poor. No well-educated teacher that I know comes into an urban school out of a secret wish to turn black and Latino babies into examination soldiers. They want to give these kids the same rich, disciplined, sequential, substantial, but also joyful education they receive in the good schools they attend. And, you know, teachers of young children especially, my friends, teachers of young children are not the servants of the global corporations or drill sergeants for the state. They have a higher destiny than that. They are ministers of innocence. They are practitioners of tender expectations. I think our teachers are going to have to learn to fight more vocally and more politically in order to defend this beautiful profession that we've chosen. And, you know, I know a lot of wonderful teachers. I know a lot of wonderful teachers of all ages who say, who I know agree with, who tell me they agree with me on everything I've said tonight, and they still say they're afraid to speak out politically because they're afraid of losing their jobs. And especially the young ones, their parents scare them. Their parents say, be careful, you might get fired if you resist this sociopathic stuff that's coming from the White House. And they're afraid, and they don't want to lose their jobs. And I always tell them, listen, you young people, life is not as dangerous as the older generation wants you to believe. Everyone I've known who's ever lost a job for a good reason ended up with a better one. And, you know, the ones I pity are the ones, the frightened souls who swallow their beliefs, who never act on their convictions, never know the taste of struggle, and never know the thrill of victory. Don't let the years go by and lose that possibility. Good luck. God bless you.
That was Jonathan Kozel on Education, the Shame of the Nation. He's a former public school teacher and an award-winning author. His new book is called The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid in American Schooling. Jonathan Kozel spoke in Portland, Oregon, in an event co-sponsored by the group Rethinking Schools. They're on the web at rethinkingschools.org. This program was produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded, award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado.